You're listening to When the Night Comes, a collection of sounds and stories from unsigned Birmingham bands between 1985 and 2005. Musicians go back in time, dusting off old demo tapes and sharing some of the tracks they wrote in bedrooms, garages and studios across the city. My name is Dean Vernals. Series 1, Episode 5 of the podcast covers the work of Rachel's Basement, and I'll be in conversation with the band's singer and songwriter, Daniel Rachel. Formed in Birmingham in the early 1990s, there were two different four-piece lineups of the band, and they played many high-profile gigs all over the UK. Despite this, a record deal would remain elusive. After Rachel's Basement, Daniel released two solo albums before going on to become a best-selling author. So, let's hear his story. Daniel, thanks for joining me on episode 5 of the podcast. Now, many people know you as the author of Isle of Noises, Walls Come Tumbling Down, Don't Look Back in Anger, but you were once a musician in an unsigned Birmingham band. But before we find out more about Rachel's Basement, let me take you back to your early days as a songwriter, if I could. What was your initial inspiration for picking up the guitar and singing?
Well, we had a Spanish guitar in the house that my brother used to play before he got his first electric guitar. He was older than me, and I just wanted to do what he could do. So I started learning chords and got a Beatles book, The Complete Beatles, and tried to teach myself chords from that and how to play. And then I got my first band was with Simon Fowler, who went on to form Ocean Colour Scene, and we were in a band called The Great Betrayal. I was bass player in that, and then Simon said one day, "You need to write songs." I said, "I've got no idea how to do that." He said, "It's dead easy. Just get your guitar, get a pen, piece of paper, cassette recorder, sit in front of it, press play and record, and sing what comes out." I did that, and I wrote my first song, and then I just wrote loads of songs. So Great Betrayal was a mix of my songs and Simon's songs. Simon was 4 years older than me, and could sing like John Lennon, and it was just amazing. He came around my house for the first time ever and sang Twist and Shout, and I distinctly remember going, "Oh my God, John Lennon's in the room." And then he sang two Velvet Underground songs, had no idea who they were. He lent me the Banana album, and from that day on, 3rd of October 1985, my life completely changed.
In your book, Isle of Noises, you describe him as your oldest friend. Was he ever a soundboard for your songs in your early days as a writer?
Absolutely. I mean, Simon and I live with each other and spend virtually every day of our lives together for about the next 10 or 15 years. He wrote virtually all of Moses Shoals on my beaten-up Yamaha Har acoustic, which we bought on City Road. And so we just used to play songs to each other. Every day we saw each other. It's like if you'd written a song and then he'd play and I'd play, and he'd help me, teach me how to sing and how to write better. And we just shared everything, and it was brilliant. Him, and he was, I was totally in awe of him as a 16-year-old. He was a pop star from the moment I met him, as far as I was concerned. It was just the best thing I'd ever heard in my life.
I guess at some point you must have thought, well, this is something I want to do for a living.
After The Great Betrayal, then that became The Fanatics. I decided to go to college to learn how to direct pop videos. And I did that for a couple of years. And then when I found out of the director of the course, so when are we doing the pop videos then? And he said, "Oh, that was just something they put in the prospectus. We won't be doing that." And he had made films of Paul Jones, of Manfred Mann and stuff. So I was really excited. So I left and came back and decided to form my own band. So that in the early 1991, and that's when I started on a path to try and get something going. I made this really expensive video as Daniel Rachel for a song called Never Let Me Know That, and which was partly filmed in Camden, me walking around Camden, and partly in a very posh studio with posh cameras and cranes and whatever else. But loads of things just didn't work or didn't happen.
And eventually this would lead you to finding the musicians you needed to start a band.
There were essentially two key lineups of Rachel's Basement. It took me a long time to finalise the first lineup, and that involved starting out with an acoustic guitar and then involving clarinet players and working out what the sound of the band was going to be. So it went through a very acoustic incarnation. And then when I met Tarek Quadri, who was a guitar player, that began to shape the direction that it would go. Spike was the drummer, who's a fantastic drummer, used to play on the local scene in blues bands that would always play in pubs, people like Trevor Burton, who'd been in The Move. So he was brilliant to get involved. And then the final guy was Paul Kelsall, who played bass. And Paul, like me, shared an absolute love of the Beatles and Bee Gees and soul music. And so we really connected musically. When Paul joined Rachel's Basement in May 1995, that was when it really changed to being the Rachel's Basement that, in my mind, that I consider the band, even though we'd had a past for a good solid year by then and been getting a lot of attention and done quite a few BBC sessions, and there'd been a lot of activity and actually quite a lot of nice press and writer across the Midlands in Brumbeat and What's On. But something just exploded once we turned electric, basically.
And coming up with the name isn't always easy. And with Rachel's Basement, there's a bit of an Ocean Colour Scene connection there, isn't there?
Well, I've got a list here at home of all the variations of what the band could have been called. And I was living at the time with Steve and Simon, and Shu, his nickname, Ian Huddy, who Simon would always say is my valet. There had been a one shoe and a two shoe, and Ian was three shoe. And three shoe said, why not Rachel's Basement? And so he, to my memory, he named the band.
And there's no apostrophe in the name, is there? What's behind that choice?
Nah, it's no big deal. I mean, people, you know, it was grammatically correct. Well, maybe it wasn't. When you write in capital letters, you don't have to use an apostrophe. So you don't have to write Rachel's with an apostrophe. But it wasn't. I just thought it was stylistic. And then it was just a thing to catch people out, because people who didn't know the band, who wrote about us, would put an apostrophe in, and those who knew about us didn't.
And you also had a logo created as well, didn't you?
I was always into all that kind of thing. The look of the band, the way it was, how you wrote the name, how everything, really. I mean, I was really driven, really, really driven as a young 20-year-old that this was going to happen and be a thing. And to make that, you have to assume that you're doing what a band does that's happening. So logos, we had T-shirts designed and used to sell loads of those. I made a fanzine for the band and collected all the early reviews and photographs of the band, and we'd sell that. Way before the internet was a thing, I got a mailing list going, and that ran to hundreds, and we would write a quite a regular newsletter that the four of us would get in the band van and drive round the whole of the Midlands, just dropping off letters and posters that and people would ask for us to sign them. We start getting loads of fan club letters. Wow. I've still got a pile of them here at the house, actually, loads of them. And then very, very quickly, I would book tours, and we would travel around the whole of the country because we had a van. That was amazing. I remember the very first day we bought it, having done, I said to the band, look, if we do 20 gigs around wherever we can, and get 150 quid for every gig, we could buy a van. If we buy a van, we can go anywhere we want, ever. And so we did all these gigs, playing for like 2 and 3 hours around any pub you could imagine in Birmingham, all the back streets, where nobody would come to see us except the Alkies. And it was brilliant because we really learned to play, and we would jam and jam and jam, and the songs would come out of jams, and we were just learning how to be a band. And at the end of it, we got the van. Paul's dad did it up for us, which was fantastic. And then I remember parking it on Spike's Drive in Moseley, and the two of us just sat in the back going, just dreaming about what we could now do because we had the van. And so we went off touring. And in all this time, I think it had built up a buzz about us as a band. So when we then started doing things like the jug, I mean, that just, that jug of ale in Moseley, that bit, it was just extraordinary. I mean, you read Brumbeat and it says that we had the box office record for the jug of ale on more than one occasion. And that was at the time of David Gray coming and Ocean Colour Scene and early incarnations of Broadcast. I mean, it was rammed to the hilt with cues down the spiral stairs and out the back. I mean, it was a really, really exciting time.
Now, although you were the songwriter, did you have any conversations about creating an overall sound?
No. The sound was naturally coming from the records that we loved. I mean, eventually when we got one of our studios at Rabanna's in the basement, we were there every single day, all day long, from midday. And then we had a record player and a sofa in there. And we'd just play, bring in all the records and just listen over and learn from the bands that we loved. And we were infectious with each other about our influences. Probably the majority influence was mine, because Tarek liked Queen and more rock. And there's an element of that in the music, which worked, but he was far more extreme in that way than I ever was. And Paul and I were really similar to one another. And Spike, I think he just got more and more into the idea of what Ringo Starr was doing and really began to understand those kind of drum fills, which he hadn't done before, because he was just a solid backbeat drummer, as I say, for these kind of bar bands. But he was brilliant at it. And his dad, of course, was the drummer of Magnum. So he'd been versed in rock as well. You wouldn't know that, I don't think. But he became such an integral feature of the band. Really great.
And how did you describe Rachel's Basement to others back in the day?
As naturally as four musicians grow together, the sound changes. So we were heavily... Well, I was obsessed by the Beatles. And so that was a major, major influence. Not that you would necessarily hear that in the music, because, you know, the best you can ever hope for to sound like the Beatles is a George Harrison song. You know, you're not going to be able to pull off one of the great Lennon and McCartney numbers. It's just a league beyond you, you know. I was really into, as a contemporary, I thought Cast were brilliant. And we all went to see Cast play before they were signed. And that night I came home and wrote a song called Stuck in a Hole. And I played it to Simon. And I said, you know, I wrote it because of John Powers, you know, that thing where he goes up high on his vocal and then comes low. And he says, you want to go and give it to John Powers? I said, you got to be kidding. He would kick me out of the room. He said, no, if somebody came up to me with a demo and said, I was inspired by your band last night to write a song, I'd be really thrilled. So I went to the next Cast gig and told John, and he said, well, we're playing in 2 weeks supporting Dodgy in Worcester. Come and bring me the tape and I'll get you lot in. So the four of us went over. We were waiting out front at 6 o'clock when the band arrived, or 4 o'clock or whatever. And I said, did you listen to the tape when they arrived? And John said, yeah. I said, what did it sound like? He said, you sound like us. That was it. I was really fond of that song. I thought that could have been a single, without a doubt. But then after that, we got a bit heavier. I'm probably a bit too influenced by Ocean Colour Scene. I mean, we were borrowing their guitars at times, and Simon was coming and singing backing vocals, or he even produced a couple of demos for us. So that became a thing. And then later, with the second incarnation of Rachel's Basement, which was with French Mac Olivier, Betsy, who had been in Weird's War on bass, and Ed Laws, who was on drums. Really, they were as musicians, way beyond me and way beyond what we'd been before. We became quite a bit heavier in the sound, I'd say.
How important was an image to a band like Rachel's Basement? How did you go about shaping a typical look?
Top Man had a retro shop they opened in the middle of town, and we used to get big shirts from there, shirts with big collars, lots of different colours, and then we'd go down the market and we'd all swap the shirts between us. Tarek and I were always fighting over this one shirt with kind of red roses on it, quite subtly done, on a white shirt. So there's loads of photos with us both wearing that shirt at different times. And we had a green one and a red shirt and a blue one. And we generally all wore kind of flared cords a bit, and then Converse and things like that. So kind of a lingering look of the Stone Roses on one hand, checking out Beatles photos on another. Yeah. Image is important to any band.
One of the ways in which bands were able to develop was by being on the Dole, wasn't it? Many had that safety net to thank.
Yeah, the Dole was essential. It's the Arts Council of Great Britain. And without it, I wouldn't have survived. I was on the Dole for 10 years straight, at least. I'm very, very thankful to the Margaret Thatcher government, the John Major government, and then the Tony Blair government. I was able to stay on the Dole. Mind you, none of those administrations made it easy. You had to justify at every corner why you were failing and why you were a disaster and why you should go and work in a factory and go and earn some money, when all the time we were working so damned hard. I mean, not only was it, you know, writing every single lyric, melody, arrangement, booking every gig that we ever did, you know, organizing the t-shirts, fixing up the van and insuring it, the whole lot. You know, I couldn't tell the dole a damn thing because they kicked me off because I wasn't earning enough money, or I wasn't prepared to confess that the band had been paid 100 quid, but we had to split that amongst the band and to pay for all our costs. It was a passion, and if you've got a passion, it just consumes you. That was me. I was obsessed by being in a band, obsessed about writing songs, and that was it. That was my life. Nothing else mattered.
And on that note, I think it's time to hear the first track you've chosen to play. This is called Our Russian Flame. Russian Flame, which was recorded at Roundall Studios down in Kent. And it's one of those songs, isn't it, like Up the Junction, Virginia Plain, where the title only appears at the end. Was that deliberate?
No. No, and unlike those two songs, I repeat the title, whereas, you know, Glenn Tilbrook only says Up the Junction once, as I recall, and so does Brian Ferry with Virginia Plain. The point of Our Russian Flame was a joke. I mean, it was, we used to finish the song, or the way I wrote the song, had that rhythm, jank 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 jank. My Maria is my latest flame, Elvis, and so rather than Maria, I called it, and coupled with the bit in the middle, I thought that sounded Russian, so it became Our Russian Flame. Oddly enough, I don't think the Spike Basement ever played that at gigs, as I seem to recall. We used to do it acoustically, and Tarek and I used to do it at acoustic gigs. And then I don't know why we chose to do it for that session, because we were brought in to do the soundtrack of a film called Only Darkness, directed by John Kirby. He directed our first video called Shake. And then he had always wanted to be a filmmaker. And I knew him from college, and so that became the lead song of the film. Whoever was that engineer or producer at that studio got something great out of us. I released on a B-side as a solo artist another Rachel's Basement song, Where We Belong, or Where I Belong, from those sessions. And there was a really cool version of Sunny But it was we only recorded half it, so they could pretend it was on the radio in the film. And then we did like Crimson Stones there, and then lots of instrumental music. I remember one track was called Wella Fella, because that was what Liam Gallagher called Noel when Noel got into Paul Weller. He'd go, Wella Fella. That's what I called it. It was like Wella Fella 1, Wella Fella 2.
And it kind of sounds like other instruments have been added to perhaps enhance the rhythmic feel of that song. Congas, maracas.
Yeah, Spike would have played any congas, and I had a pair of black maracas wrapped round wooden handles, wrapped round with grey, not masking tape, you know, gaffer. And the triplets, I can hear that must have come from watching Steve put percussion on Ocean Colour Scene tracks. And whether I could play that in time is probably debatable. So that may be me and I got it, but I may have been sacked and then Spike would have done it.
Now, I'd quite like to ask you a bit more about the songwriting process, if I could. Because of your conversations with great British songwriters in your book, Isle of Noises, have you approached the art form in many different ways over the years?
Not really. I mean, I virtually did it the same as that very first time I said to you, just sit in front of a cassette recorder and sing. But virtually every single one of my songs came like that. Get one or two chords together that sound all right, and then just start singing over the top of it. One of the rare exceptions was Quit Your Low Down Ways, because I remember seeing a couple of documentaries. One of them was the Ali Foreman fight, Rumble in the Jungle, and what a magnificent film, great story. And Norman Mailer said in that Ali, for the first time in his life, Ali received a punch greater than his own. I thought, wow, what an idea. So I thought that should be in a song. And then there was this documentary about Ruth Snyder, the last woman to be put on the electric chair in the 20s in America, and the story behind the photograph that got on the front page of all the nationals in America was an extraordinary story, because you weren't allowed to take cameras into the state prison where she was executed. And so I tried to crunch that into a single verse. So the odd thing was, I remember going out for a walk on the Clent Hills with my mate Kate and saying, I've got this idea, and was telling her all about the idea. And it was all new to me, because I'd never, ever tried to write a set of lyrics before I wrote a song before. So that really stands out to me.
I've seen a quote of yours, actually, where you said that songs seem to help define you and you're forging your identity. And that's quite an important point to make, isn't it?
Yeah, of course they do. I mean, I think my whole education really comes from records and music, you know, and that's, you know, a large part of that was coming out of things like Two Tone. And when I'd learned all the lyrics to Concrete Jungle and Rat Race by the Specials, and I would then reflect upon those ideas and It Doesn't Make It All Right, and realize that had formed the way I thought about the world. You know, that originally they were just songs to sing along to and dance to, and then you realize, oh no, that's why I began to think in those kind of ways, because, you know, all Rankin Roger singing what's the thing in Doors of Your Heart, put him in the living room, turn out like, don't know if he's black or white, you know, those kind of things. It's like, wow, God, that's I took, you know, I thought that was a philosophy in itself. And, you know, I was pretty thick at school, bottom sets for everything. And so, you know, yeah, music does define you in those kind of ways. Nelson Mandela, my God, when I got the single for that, and you flip over the cover and it's got the whole history of the African National Congress and what Nelson Mandela had been going through. That was my education. Wow. My God, Racist Friend, there's another one. Doesn't matter if he's your mother, your brother, your sister or your lover, get rid of your racist friends. I'm flipping hell. This is hardcore. Jerry Dammer's, you know, God, I'm in awe of that man.
I've also seen you refer to lyrics as a kind of call to arms. Are the songs of your own you'd file under that category?
I've never written anything like Pete Townsend, like meet the old boss, same as the new boss. God, I was never going to get a job after that when I'd worked out what that meant. I don't think so. Not my own songs. No, not really. I was struggling enough to make sense of myself, well, I've always been really self-conscious, find it very difficult to strike to just forget myself, which is why it's so beautiful being on stage, because you do forget yourself. So, and my self-consciousness was in my words, I think. They were too wrapped up with trying to be clever, you know. I needed a lesson off Noel Gallagher. Just write it straight, man. Get down to it, you know.
And one of the questions you ask Paul Weller in the book Isle of Noises is when do you know it's time to write? Do you know yourself?
I just always did. Always. There was always, as I say, in the flat in Moseley, my Yamaha was just lying around wherever, and Simon and I would just be always picking it up, and you just pick it up and write. And then, you know, as the band got a set together, and I just wanted to write newer songs.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned before the interview was that some of the stories you may have read or seen weren't necessarily true. For example, you said that you met Marc Olivier, who was in the second version of the band, after you moved to Paris, and he joined you on stage for an impromptu version of Velvet Underground's I'm Waiting for the Man.
Yeah, I mean, that was just, God, I was always making up stories, just trying to think of something funny. Marc and I construed that. It's completely fabricated. It was like, it's the real story is so boring. It was like, I remember saying to Mach, we can't say that. What can we come up with? And so that sounded much better. That got in the press a few places, which is always funny. I was born in lots of different places in the press: Manchester, London, Birmingham, Solihull, and then and my age changes in every interview you ever read about me. I believed in rock and roll years. Rock and roll years are defined by leap years. So you only age once every 4 years. I thought that was quite a good idea.
And being the front man, did you ever consider your sort of stage presence at any point?
Whenever I was on stage, I felt entirely relaxed and at home. And I mean, I remember Simon always used to say to me that he was envious of how relaxed and conversational I could be, and he wished he could talk like I could talk between songs. I mean, I just had utter confidence, and I think it was because we'd always rehearsed hard, really damned hard, and if you know you've the band's on it and can play, then it doesn't matter really. The thing I always used to say was I would be apprehensive about a gig or a particular night, but I never was nervous or anything, because we sounded great. We were always tight. And I remember saying to one older guy who Spike and Tarek used to knock around with, and I said, oh my God, like, you know, I got that thing again last night where you just have like an out of body experience when you're singing a certain note or on stage and everything's disappeared and you're just inside this mad thing. And he said, whoa, God, you know, I've only had that about two times in my whole life. You need to cherish those moments. I said, God, I get them virtually all the time. You know, I go to every three or four a week. Of course, since I stopped being a musician, that's the thing I miss most. You know, those were incredible, incredible moments. There's a moment I remember. I know you're going to play later a track called Quit Your Low Down Ways. And I think on the final chorus, I remember being at Rockfield and hitting the note of, on the chorus of and going into this crazy headspace, and I remember I flipped and went into this strange live bubble, as if nothing else in the world didn't exist except this strange black space, and I was in it, and it's the most magical location or you could ever want to be in your life. And I hit it in the studio. My God, next time I ever hear that track, I can hear and visualise myself back in that moment.
Well, let's hear it now, actually. This is Quit Your Low Down Ways.
Said the only night in history. achieve a punch greater than mine. To see Snyder angry, but what I cannot believe are the tears of young Ruth Ellis truly grieved.
That was Quit Your Low Down Ways by Rachel's Basement. And what do you remember about arranging that one with the band?
The important thing of that song was detuning the top E string down to a D, so you could play D but with it open. And then to play D, G and A, which it was, to play the G and the A, you had to do something on the third fret and then something up on the fifth fret, which I slid up to. So it kind of didn't sound like three chords to me. And that was the key to that song. And then it was just kind of a Dylan thing, really. And the outro that you heard, I remember I borrowed A Northern Soul by The Verve, and I could never quite decide on The Verve at that point. But there was something, they always seemed to have this thing where they just rambled on a chord and Richard Ashcroft would kind of make noises or do stuff. And I incorporated that into the end of that song. But the thing to me about Quit Your Low Down Ways, I mean, Mach's arrangement of that is just fantastic. All his electric guitar playing and the dissonant chord as it goes into the third verse. And then the build up to the final chorus, and then Betsy does that bass thing, down, 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 da ba da ba down. That riff kind of thing, you know, all his influence of Norman Watt Roy and the guy out of Elvis Costello and the Attractions was coming to the fore. And I always felt, you know, the song builds and builds, and then it just releases on Betsy's riff. Oh, I love doing that song. Very proud of that one. We did it at Rockfield, and we had to film it for a TV program. And Mark, yeah. If I see Mark now, he still says, "Oh, Daniel, you broke the." He's become German. God, but, you broke the mic, and I did because I was always a bit of a loose cannon on stage. I mean, I mean, Mark got so angry with me when I scratched or broke bits off his Martin acoustic, but in there. I'd throw guitars like off to the guitar roadie on the side stand, and he'd catch them and things like that, and not thinking that this guitar's worth £1,500 or something. And then and at Rockfield, they had a Neumann mic that were worth a couple of grand each. Yeah. And I remember just doing the stage thing because it was on TV, and I broke it. It's like, oh no! Yeah, it was good fun that was. We were next door to Manic Street Preachers when they were recording A Design for Life when we were there. And then we inherited the fridge of Nigel Kennedy in the room that we stayed in, and he was a vegetarian. There's all this fantastic fruit, and being on the dole, I mean, just hardly ever ate. He used to boil a broccoli and have rice with it, and then to have all this luscious, colourful food was fantastic. Yeah, it's a great experience, Rockfield.
Now, some illustrious bands have recorded there, haven't they? Queen, Oasis, Stone Roses. How did you end up recording at Rockfield?
Betsy sorted it out, and Paul, the engineer, Paul Reed, was up for doing something in some downtime. Paul was brilliant, very, very relaxed. I don't know what came of him. I hope he became a big producer. I know he was engineer on big sessions, and so that was just amazing. Yeah, we'd heard Bohemian Rhapsody was recorded there. Not that I cared about Queen, but we did. But on the one of those songs, I think it's Shot in the Dark, or maybe it was one of those. Ed played the chord, the opening chord of Bohemian Rhapsody, and then we flipped the tape, and it's on the reverse. So the introduction of the song is Bohemian Rhapsody introduction. I was more excited because Adam Leanse had recorded Kings of the Wild Frontier there, which is the first record I ever bought. And so I was always saying to Paul, "Can you get out the tapes? And is it true that Amp Music was the drumsticks were played on the gate door?" I don't think it is true. But and Mark was excited because Iggy Pop had done New Values there, I think. And yeah. And then we knew, and of course Oasis had been there, Charlatans down the road. It's just we great mammoth table tennis games me and Ed upstairs were doing, and then residential studio for a week. And we went back there again for another week. We had a whale of a time. Really, that was just great. You know, you've seen that footage of the Stone Roses there where they put their back on a chair and their feet on a chair, and then you have to try and pull the two chairs apart while staying on it, and you see Ian Brown falling in between. I'd seen that kind of footage and just thought, wow, we're going there where the Roses have been.
And I guess you must have attracted some record company interest.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a great shame, really, because we had lots of flirtations with record labels. I mean, I've got a succession of letters starting, you know, before I'd even probably done half a dozen gigs, you know, rejections from Virgin Records. We spent a week in the studio courtesy of Island Records. Chapter 22 checked us out. Somebody from Gut Records. We went to Woodbine Studios where Ghost Town had been recorded. You know, the time in Rockfield. We spent a week at UB40 Studio. There were lots of labels coming up to see us and talking with us. MCA funded us for a while. I remember when we supported Ocean Colour Scene at Wolverhampton, and Chris Craddock, the Ocean Colour Scene manager, came running into our dressing room going, "I'm going to manage you. That was amazing. Listen to that." And the whole auditorium was ringing, you know, and we'd just done 30 minutes support. You know, there was a lot of that going on. And then the first lineup split up two nights before we were due to support Ocean Colour Scene on the Moses Shoals tour at Hammersmith Palais. And I'd always had this big thing, let's not play London until we've created a real stir and a buzz, not only in the Midlands, but around the country. Because we would, you know, be forever going to Leeds, to Sheffield, to Brighton, wherever, Aberystwyth, Buckley, Tivoli. We played everywhere and built up followings. And then it was like, right, when we go down to London, Hammersmith Palais, that's the night the A&R. And it all felt like it's about to happen. And then the three of them sacked me or walked out of me. I don't know. Yeah, I think they all said, we're all leaving. I couldn't believe it.
Now, you mentioned about record companies coming to see you, but was that local gigs as well?
Labels did come to Birmingham. They might not always make themselves known. And plus the fact all major cities had scouts and knew the promoters, whether that was Arthur Tapp or Dave Travis, Connell Dodds, people like that. So the labels could phone up the scouts and say, what's going on? Or Mike Davis at Brumbeat was very, very important for that. Steve Morris, Brumbeat later. And they would have conversations saying, what's going on? Who's drawing crowds or who's making a bit of a stir? So even if you felt that they weren't onto you, they were definitely there. You'd probably find interviews of me saying, oh, they can't be bothered to come 100 miles up the motorway. But I don't think that actually that is so true.
Now, aside from touring and building up a fan base around the UK, you also had to find larger venues to play here in Birmingham, didn't you, such as the Custard Factory?
Yeah, we did that a couple of times. The Custard Factory was brilliant, and I did that with the second incarnation of Rachel's Basement when the pubs were too small for us. And so we said we need to organise our own gig. We both played the Custard Factory outside over the water, but we also hired a whole empty space which held 400 or 500 people. I mean, you've got to put this in perspective that no Birmingham gig, pub gig, was bigger than 100, 120 people. Officially, we packed out the Custard Factory and we got an artist company called Shawley to design and decorate the whole room. I had visions of the factory, you know, Andy Warhol's factory, and using art like the Velvets, using art and music. And that was an incredible night as well. Just the sense of the support backing we got from Brummies was brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic that. Now let's hear the next track you've chosen to play. This is Too Much High Living.
Living each and every smile.
Too Much High Living by Rachel's Basement. Earlier you mentioned a heavier side to the band, and that's an example of it, isn't it?
Again, it would have started with me on the acoustic guitar. Every song I ever wrote on the acoustic guitar, and then, you know, by the time you get Mark and Betsy riffing on that, I mean, they love doing counted riffs and working out the frequency of the guitars here, the bass is there, and they had such technical knowledge and understanding of music way beyond anything that I could keep up with. I mean, they were hard players, and Mark taught me that in the studio. If you hear a kind of softly guitar on a Stones record, for example, Keith Richards won't be playing that acoustic soft. It'd be quite an ugly, hardish sound. But when you translate that amongst the other instruments, it will take on a newer sound. And it's learning those kind of ideas of how to make records that you don't necessarily play what the sound of the record will be. And we were learning all those kind of things, or I was. But then by the time that came out in early 98, I mean, when the record companies were looking at us, that whole guitar thing had passed. You know, the big thing was Travis and David Gray and music like that. That whole, what had been originally Britpop with Elastica and Park Life and that kind of thing, and Supergrass, and had become heavier through Paul Weller and Oasis and Ocean Colour Scene. And by the time that we were getting it together, then Princess Diana died, and the whole national mood changed, really. And darkness wasn't in. They wanted something frivolous and lighter than had been. And then, of course, Mark said, "I'm leaving." So, again, we're just getting it together. And again, somebody wants out.
And where are you coming from lyrically with that one, Daniel?
No idea. I really don't know what that song, the 10-foot high lovers, my each and every smile. I'd have to, I can't stand it. I don't know. I don't know what that, that's one of those where you just sing, I just sing in words. And I've probably got a narrative as I'm doing it in my head. Yeah, I mean, Ed used to say that to me. Your lyrics don't mean anything. I don't really understand them. I go, "What about Quit Your Low Down Ways?" He goes, "No, I still don't know what it means, though." All right, well, that put me in my place.
And listening back to all three tracks, what's your feeling about them today?
No, my greater regret is some songs that weren't recorded or weren't recorded well enough. So I wish there was a great version of Stuck in a Hole. And then there was, I loved a song called Sunny, which is really pop.
Sunny, you're so funny. Oh, you could smile on better days whenever we're together.
And In My Shoes, remember that went down really well at one of the Ocean Colour Scene supports. Ba, ba, ba. I was just had an introduction, a bit like ABBA. Just one look and then I saw it, just the riff of that. There were some songs like that. Crimson Stones is always a big thing at the end of the set, but we had to go recording that. And it's just songs that they didn't quite get in the studio. That's just more of a frustration for one reason or another. Shake on the Video, 6 months later, I would have sung those verses stronger. But the outro is very exciting. And then me and Paul on the backing vocals pretending to be George and Paul going, shake, 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 shake. You know, things like that are great. But Russian Flame didn't used to be so guitar overdriven. But that was a lighter thing with clarinets on it that would have been quite interesting to hear that back now. And Quit Your Lowdown Ways, I'm really... really proud of. I think that was a big song for us.
Now, we've talked about many of the high profile gigs you played and record companies coming along to see you. But what do you think were the key things that prevented you from becoming a signed band?
Partly because by the second incarnation with French Basement is that the music scene had changed. There was the first incarnation at the point of doing the Hammersmith Palais gigs, the other three left the band. Sometimes we mucked it up in the studio and didn't quite nail it. And then early on, when it was more of an acoustic pastoral sound, I mean, it was just too early. I mean, I went down to 4, 5, 6 record labels with my acoustic guitar, just literally turned up and went in the office and played in front of people. So timing was an issue.
not choosing the right songs or not quite getting it right in the studio, being too much like other bands, or, you know, the worst thing is if the music industry say Britpop's a big thing, guitar bands, if you're that bad, if you sound anything like that, then you missed it, because they're now looking at the next thing because they've already got what they need for that thing. So that was definitely an element. And just, you know, at the end of the day, if you don't get signed, you weren't good enough.
And you talked about a potential manager earlier. Would that have made a significant difference, do you think?
It was tough because I was managing us, but it's no good advocating yourself, is it really? We needed a proper manager. That was a major, major problem. Yeah. When I went on to do solo records, I used to lie and I became Danny Blenheim because I'd lived on Blenheim Road, and I'd blag it and pretend I was the manager, and suddenly loads more things happened.
I think a lot of the bands I've spoken to on this podcast would have benefited from a manager, definitely. Now, if you'd been around today, do you think you'd have been more successful?
The critical difference, but I mean, bear in mind, as a caveat to this, it's a level playing field for everybody. The difference being is that the internet was not developed as a way of sharing, but MySpace doesn't come into what, 2003, 2004, in the 90s. So when I say that we toured around the country and had a massive fan base, there was no way beyond buying stamps and sending letters and going to those people to garner and utilize that support. And if there'd been social media platforms then, the hits on our website or whatever, that the way of measuring Facebook, or if I had a Facebook page or Twitter account, we would have had a phenomenal account compared to any other Midland band, without a doubt. You know, because we were coming up, you know, with, even when bands like Ocean Colour Scene hadn't quite made it yet, they didn't make it till 96 second time round. Their support really flopped. And we were on the ascendancy, and all those bands around us, we were playing way bigger gigs, and we could see that around the country as well, that we were, comparative to our city, we were obviously the biggest unsigned band in Birmingham. That was what the catch line was in the press. So that would have had a profound effect on us. And I think also, I don't know why I didn't do it, but we should have released our own record on an independent, I think. Albeit, I mean, that's the point at which that didn't work anymore in the music industry. Once Blur had blown open the doors, you know, beyond, say, Powder on Parkway Records or something, that isn't really independent anyway. But the idea of doing an independent single had kind of gone off the radar, I guess. But that could have been a thing, to go out on our own. I don't know. It's all, you know, it didn't happen. There you are, full stop, you know. Thank God I worked out to do something else in later life.
And talking about releasing your own tunes, after Rachel's Basement, you went solo, didn't you? And recorded a couple of albums after founding Dust Records.
Yeah, I mean, Dust Records was a kind of a great success in a way. And as I say, and I suddenly, you know, realised how to garner national press and how to get national radio play, try and get on some supports, and all those things came about. And in a way, the kind of the level of writing about me and what I was doing, yeah, as I say, was on a national basis. So that was better. Again, it never quite worked. I mean, Let It Be Mine was an independent top 30, and Hearts and Bones, which featured Kate Rusby's band. I mean, that was within the media. There was like the tip sheets within the record industry, and that was the big song, and there was all kinds of approaches being made and showcases done, and that, and you know, nonsense in the end, you're going to be the next big thing, and then that doesn't, none of it came true, and by that time I'm looking at 40 knocking on the door. And I just thought, oh no, you know, the idea of going, I've got a new song, it would be just embarrassing, wouldn't it, really? Because I hadn't properly accepted that I could be more in the acoustic folk tradition, that would be more accepting of being older. You know, my heart was in pop music. And so when I heard Alex Turner and when I heard Arctic Monkeys, I just thought, that's what I wanted to be. That's what I wanted to do. And I just thought, he's done it. That's it.
Now, your two solo albums were 5 years apart, weren't they? A Simple Twist of Folk in 2001 and A Taste of Money in 2006.
It was because I had no money. I was still on the dole. And I couldn't find a band, and I was just struggling. I just could not find a way to record or get things going. All my equipment was bust up and beaten up, and I didn't want to do an introductory acoustic-y album in the way I ramshackled a Simple Twist of Folk together. And I wanted to do something more up and with arrangements and musicians, and I was reliant on people's help and free will. I worked with Grant Showbiz, who produced The Fall, and Billy Bragg, and did I did a couple of 7-inches in before the album came out. And again, it didn't quite get it. And it was never Rachel's Basement. That was the problem. I just wanted it to be Rachel's Basement. And yet I'm trying to be a solo artist, trying to recreate Rachel's Basement, but not being in a band. And I was caught between what I was trying to do and just trying to do anything. So that's why there was a space and delay and an inconsistency, I guess, in the sound of the second record.
And you did rework an old Rachel's Basement song on A Taste of Money, a track called Pearl.
Yeah, Pearl. And there was quite a few songs that have been Rachel's Basement songs. And in fact, Face the Sun is the original Rachel's Basement recording. In fact, that what I should have done is just use the original recordings for loads of it. Pearl had started off with Spike Basement, and we did it in a very different way. I think I wrote it starting off like a pastiche of you Know My Name, Look Up the Number, the B-side of Let It Be. And also a kind of cross with an Otis Redding idea has just occurred to me as I sing that. Probably knew that at the time. And then when I did it with French Basement, then Mark kind of rearranged it quite a bit and gave it a newer feel and a better feel. And then when I recorded it for Taste of Money, then I was aware that I think that's a really strong vocal, actually. And I was really pleased with that one. I was really in control of my singing by then and could just kind of put down what I wanted. But yeah, Pearl was great.
Well, I think we should take a listen to it, actually.
If it's blonde you want, you just can't give any more. If the blonde of the curl is the only girl on the floor, you'll take a lot of leaving when you leave to go home. You'll leave a life of meaning to live. Across the room, the click of the print of the footstep sets its mold. To share these blue surroundings, passing flower walls, send out your invitations. The sound of the wind.
That was called Pearl from Daniel Rachel's solo album A Taste of Many. And it featured brass on that one, didn't it? What inspired that?
It was working with Marc Olivier, who did all the arrangements, and just being free to just say, what do I hear on this song? You know, some songs had string arrangements and other songs had brass. Brass was the obvious one, really. It's not real brass. That was Mark. He had a sampler. I would come up with brass lines. I would hum things to Mark. And Mark would go, no, no, Daniel. Brass players can't play like that. You have to do it like this. Or I'll come up with string lines. And he'd say, no, no, they're fingering. Daniel, you have to have a proper understanding of music. You know nothing. And he'd kind of tell me off and say, this is how you do it. And, you know, he had a classical understanding of music. And he understood it because his dad was a great Spanish guitar player. And I just felt it like I heard it on records, you know. So, it's all good. You know, it's a good recording. And I think those songs are on, maybe on iTunes, maybe on Spotify. They're there somewhere or other, you know. So it exists in one form or other.
So there you are as a musician, recording solo material. And then suddenly you're on a different path to writing your first book. How did that happen?
I just said it one day, literally. I'd read a book 7 or 8 years earlier called Songwriters on Songwriting by Paul Zollo, and I went back to the shop on Charing Cross Road, and I said, can I have the British version, please? And they said, there isn't one. And I went, I was still a musician, so I didn't think anything of it. And then when nothing came of Hearts and Bones to the level I wanted it to, I just literally one day said, I'm going to be an author. I'm going to write that music book. And then as I want to do, I just went round and shouted it to everybody who came across my way. So I'm going to write a book so that I'd be a total embarrassment if I didn't do it. And so I set about doing it and tried to work out how do you get in contact with Jimmy Page and get in a room with him. It was as stupid as that. How do you find Sting? I wonder how you find Sting. Oh, go on Google. Sting, where do you live? What's your phone number? And it started like that, really. And it took me years because I was Billy No One, and I was just laughed off the phone, really. And I persevered, and then Island Noises was, you know, became a book of the year. So,
yeah, great lesson in persistence, and a thoroughly good read as well. So, finally, do you still write and record music these days?
No. No, I've had an upright piano since my 20s, and I'm still trying to learn how to play rock and roll. So I bash around on that, drink lots of coffee to get the 16ths on the high end, you know, really. I bought a Madness songbook the other day, Divine Madness. So I could play a few Madness tracks, like Return of the Lost Palmer 7 and My Girl. And I learned a lot of Beatles songs on the piano, Martha, My Dear, and Lady Madonna. But no, I mean, the one thing I did do when I had kids, for a little while, their piano was in their bedroom. And every night I'd just go in and make a song up every single night to send them to sleep. That was the last time I wrote songs, I think. I'd just go in and just go, Lottie, today, what have you done? You went to the shop and you bought some sand. Can you believe it? And just start, you know, making up songs every single night for probably a year. And then they get quite elaborate. Oh, and I wrote a song for Laura Marling once. I was her librarian for a 20-night run in a massive house in East London. And they had this idea that I should write this diary. And instead I wrote, and Laura was just turning up in odd rooms singing Bruce Springsteen songs. So I said to the director, why don't I just write a song for Laura and see if she'll sing that? So I did and sent it to her. And I think it's in the bin somewhere.
Oh, no. And on that note, I think that's just about it, really. Thanks for joining me. Some fascinating stories. And it's been great to hear some of the tracks. So finally, long live the music of Rachel's Basement.
Thanks very much for having me.
When the Night Comes was written and produced by me, Dean Vernals. If you've enjoyed the music in this episode, or were in a Birmingham band and would like to share your story, then get in touch at wtncpodcast@mail.com. That's wtncpodcast@mail.com. Thanks for listening.